Thanks for being here tonight. Some of you, how many of you thought we were starting at 7 o'clock? Some of you. At one point, the lecture was at 7, and then we got pushed back by the honors lecture tonight, and then I just got all confused and was telling some people 7, some people 7:30. So I apologize. I will get started right now, actually, a little bit, 1 minute ahead of time. Welcome to tonight's lecture for the Comparison Project series. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake and direct the Comparison Project, which is a public program in comparative religion. Each year we take a particular theme. This year our theme is religion beyond words, or ineffability, in big philosophical speak. Each year we take a theme and then we explore that theme in various religious traditions. Tonight we're going to be looking at the religious tradition of Taoism, a Chinese religion. We are generously supported by 6 sources of funding: Drake University's Humanities Center, Drake University's Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, Humanities Iowa, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Deming Foundation, and the Medbury Fund. One of those funders, Humanities Iowa, you've heard this before, most of you, requires us to take attendance at our events, and to that end, I'm going to pass around a binder. If you'd be so kind at least to write your name on that, we'll know how many people were here. And if you want to be on our emailing list or on Humanities Iowa's emailing list, there's a place to provide your email address and check a box. Lewis, our lecturer for tonight, Lewis Kamioff, also has a handout in addition to his PowerPoint, and I'm going to send that around right now too.
So,
There's a little more information on the rest of our programming for the year, way kind of in the back on one of those tables. We've got an event 3 weeks from tonight on West African religion, and the day after that a workshop on West African dance. That's a really exciting part of the programming that we were able to add just a few weeks ago. And then 3 weeks after that we'll have our final lecture of the year, which is on Sikhism, a little known Indian religion, and on mysticism in the Sikh religion. Tonight, though, we're delighted to have with us Lewis Kamioff, a really top-notch scholar of Taoism, and a friend of mine. We went to the same graduate program in Boston University, though God knows, or Tao knows, I could never have studied Taoism. Instead, I studied Christian mysticism. Lewis is now an assistant professor of Chinese religions and comparative religious studies at the University of San Diego. He's a leading scholar of Taoism with special interest in contemplative practice and mystical experience. He's the founding co-chair of the Taoist Studies Group at the American Academy of Religion, which is the professional society for scholars who study religion. He's also the founding co-chair of the Contemplative Studies Group for the American Academy of Religion, and he's the manager of the Contemplative Studies website. If you go to his own website, you'll find all sorts of great resources on contemplative studies. Lewis has published a sickingly amount of books. That's not really good grammar, is it? 6 in the last 12 years or something, or so I count, and there's probably like 5 more coming out next year. The title Index to Taoist Collections in 2002, Cultivating Perfection, Mysticism and Self-Transformation in Early Kuan-Zhen Taoism in 2007. Handbooks for Taoist Practice in 2008, The Way of Complete Perfection, a Kuan-Zhen Taoist Anthology in 2013. The Taoist Tradition, an Introduction, 2013, which my class is reading some of and really enjoying. And just recently, Taoism, A Guide for the Perplexed, in 2014. Not even released yet in the States. Soon to come out in the States. Lewis is also a member of the Advisory Board for Monastic Interreligious Dialogue and the founding co-director of the Taoist Foundation, a nonprofit religious and educational organization dedicated to fostering authentic Taoist study and practice. Tonight he's going to lecture on a topic that is named Names Are the Guest of Reality, Apophasis, Mysticism, and Soteriology in Taoist Perspective. Please join me in welcoming Lewis Kamioff again.
Thanks. Is the sound all right? Can you hear me through the microphone? Okay. Well, hello and welcome. Thank you for coming. I want to thank Professor Knepper and the Comparison Project for the opportunity to speak to you today. If you've not done so already, please silence or turn off your cell phones. The primary title of my talk is an allusion to Chapter 1 of the Zhuangzi, the Book of Master Zhuang, which is a central text of classical Taoism and one of the most influential scriptures in the Taoist tradition. It expresses the foundational Taoist view that each and every name and conception is limited. Names and knowing and thinking by extension are ultimately unable to express experience and reality. For Taoists, actual practice and experience are primary. In the case of classical Taoism, this centers on apophatic meditation aimed at mystical union with the Tao. In my presentation, I will in turn focus on apophatic or negational discourse, mysticism, that is experiences of the sacred, and soteriology, the ultimate purpose of human existence. In the process, in keeping with Professor Knepper's Comparative Grammars of Ineffability project, I will give particular attention to the actual linguistic dimensions of Taoism. So let me begin with a story from the Book of Master Zhuang. Master Zhuang and Master Hui were strolling along the dam of the Hao River when Master Zhuang said, "See how the minnows come out and dart around as they please. That's what fish really like." Master Hui said, "You're not a fish, so how do you know what fish like?" Master Zhuang said, "You're not me, so how do you know that I don't know what fish like?" Master Hui said, "I'm not you, so I certainly don't know what you know. On the other hand, you're certainly not a fish, so that still proves you don't know what fish like." Master Zhuang said, "Let's go back to your original question. You asked me how I know what fish like, so you already knew I knew it when you asked. I know it by standing here beside the Hao River." This passage derives from chapter 17, which is titled Autumn Floods. It is a dialogic exchange between Zhuangzi, Master Zhuang, an elder of classical Taoism, Daojia, and Huizi, Master Hui, a representative of the terminologist or logician school, Mingjia, with the latter interested in philosophical debates, especially concerning terminology and conceptualization. The conversation draws our attention to the central Taoist concern for being and experiencing over knowing and thinking. In the language of philosophy, there is a greater concern for ontology than epistemology. Rooted in a participatory model of existence, the primary aspiration centers on a radically different way of perceiving and acting, or non-acting, in keeping with Taoist views. As with many other sections of the Book of Master Zhuang, this passage is often interpreted in terms of philosophy, quote-unquote, specifically as ideas or thought, quote-unquote, extracted from a larger Taoist worldview and corresponding practices and experiences. It is read as a philosophical debate rather than a non-debate about direct experience, participatory experience. However, like the fish playing among the sunlight and shadows, Master Zhuang, who also represents accomplished Taoist adepts, participates in the transformative process of the Tao through his own carefree wandering, Xiao Yao Yo, and making all things equal, Qi Wu. In this way, it supports my primary interpretation of the text, namely that it expresses a contemplative and mystical perspective that becomes a source of confusion or argumentation for non-contemplatives or non-mystics. Before moving into the specifics of my presentation, I'd like to provide some foundational information on Taoism in general, as well as classical Taoism and the Book of Master Zhuang in particular. So in this slide, we can kind of see that, from my perspective, the most basic understanding is Taoism as the tradition of the Tao. It's spelled Taoism with a T in the older Wei-Giles romanization system, but it's still pronounced Taoism. It's an indigenous Chinese religion deeply rooted in traditional Chinese culture. It focuses on the Tao, translatable as the way or and a way, which is the Taoist sacred or ultimate concern. It begins as a religious community, so this is one of my fundamental views that is different from many other scholars of Taoism, during the Warring States period, so 480 to 222 BCE. This Western name approximates a variety of indigenous Chinese terms, including Dao Jia, which literally means the family of the Tao or the family of the way, Dao Jiao, the teachings of the Tao, and Xuan Feng, mysterious movement. So Xuan, which I'll talk about later, is another name that Taoists use to talk about the Tao, mysterious or mysteriousness. Taoists are adherents of Taoism. They are people who are part of the tradition of the Tao and who endeavor to transmit the Tao, Chuan Tao. Also, I think another important point is that Taoism is now a global religious tradition. It's not just an indigenous Chinese religion. So I tend to make a distinction between Chinese Taoism and global Taoism. And so global Taoism is still rooted in Chinese Taoism as the source tradition. Also, it's important to be thinking about like our own intellectual genealogies and contexts of reception. So like Zen Buddhism before it, Taoism is the object of various Western fictions, fabrications, and fantasies. The Tao is the sacred and ultimate concern of Taoists. Taoist theology, or discourse on the sacred, centers on the Tao. It is first and foremost a Chinese character, as well as a Taoist cosmological and theological concept. Etymologically speaking, the character Tao, probably pronounced something like Dao in archaic and ancient Chinese, consists of tuo and shou, so to walk and head. It is a road that one travels, and a religious or existential path by extension. Tao may thus mean path, way, to walk, and to speak. Like qi and yin and yang, Tao is best left untranslated, though it has been rendered as way. Here it is important to recognize that Tao was part of the shared intellectual and conceptual repertoire of ancient China. In that context, various individuals and movements discoursed on Tao. However, more often than not, such individuals meant their specific way or path, quote unquote. In contrast, the inner cultivation lineages of classical Taoism elevated the concept of Tao to designate that which is ultimately real, the way, that which transcends and encompasses all the small Taos, the small ways. So, Tim, I'm having trouble reading this, so I'm just going to have to like the screens, just so you know.
Sure.
Okay, so this is the first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, the scripture on the Tao and inner power. The Tao that can be spoken is not the constant Tao. The name that can be named is not the constant name. Nameless, the beginning of the heavens and earth. Named, the mother of the 10,000 beings. Thus, constantly desireless, one may observe its subtlety. Constantly desiring, one may observe its boundaries. These two emerge from the sameness, but differ in name. This sameness is called mysterious. Mysterious, and again more mysterious, the gateway to all that is wondrous. So in this opening, really famous chapter from the Tao Te Ching, you can see here these characters, Xuan, which I mentioned to you before, means mysterious. And one of the really interesting parts of this text is that it feeds into the Taoist tradition, where Taoists start to talk about the Tao as a twofold mystery. So I'll be getting into the language shortly, but if you just look at these lines here, it actually says, Xuan zhi yo xuan, so yo, even more, or also, yo xuan, even more mysterious, of the mysterious. That's how mysterious it is. So, right, so you want a name for it, we'll give you a description, Xuan, mysterious. And then we tell you, it's even more mysterious than that. So this is a kind of Taoist view of what the sacred, or what's ultimately real, is. Another interesting part of this is, Xuan can mean many different things, but one thing it can mean is darkness. So I don't know how much you've thought about different conceptions of the sacred, but the ways that certain people will conceptualize the sacred in terms of light, right? Taoists tend to prefer to conceptualize in terms of darkness, not with negative connotations, right? In the sense of mystery. So another way to kind of think about this line is darkness within darkness. That's the Tao. It's not a mistake. The Tao cannot be separated from the religious tradition, which is Taoism. It is a Taoist cosmogonic, cosmological, and theological category. From a Taoist perspective, the Tao has four characteristics. So the first characteristic the Taoists tend to talk about is the source of everything. The second one is an unnameable mystery. We already saw this, so I'll return to this in a moment. But the idea that even talking about it as the Tao is not it. Okay? So it's unnameable and it's mysterious. It's an all-pervading sacred presence. So the category or the concept of qi in traditional Chinese culture, that is, there's an energetic reality to it. This is radically different than a lot of other religious traditions. You experience it energetically. It's not just intellectual, it's not emotional, it's not just physical. There's actually an energetic component to reality and human being. And then lastly, the universe as a kind of transformative process. So Taoists tend to talk about this in terms of nature as a whole. Right? Nature on some level is the Tao. In keeping with one of our central topics, ineffability or unspeaking, quote unquote, veneration of the Tao and commitment to realizing the Tao involves recognition of the character as a placeholder for and reflection on the Taoist, on Taoist theological views. To mistake Tao for is either idolatry or a mistaken view. Thus, even the Taoist theological concept of Tao, quote unquote, points beyond itself. I will return to the centrally important Taoist view shortly. Another key aspect of Taoist views related to contemplative practice, mystical experience, and apophatic discourse centers on cosmogony, or the origins of the universe. So this is my attempt to approximate Taoist cosmogony. If you look at this, there's a movement from some kind of unrepresentable before. This is how Taoists tend to talk about it. You can't actually know what it was before there was some kind of spontaneous change that started to manifest as the phenomenal universe. So it's an unrepresentable before, moving into primordial undifferentiation. So primordial undifferentiation still isn't what it was before it all began. Moving into yin and yang, so starting a deeper process of differentiation and then into probably the cosmology that some of you are familiar with, yin and yang in dynamic interaction and the five phases, the wu xing. So there's a movement from undifferentiation to differentiation, and one of the things that Taoists are really interested in is going back. So how do you return to a state of non-differentiation? And then you can see on the right that I'm kind of dividing this up conceptually. So apophatic, that is, it's indescribable at that point. Okay. Then you move into a kind of monistic view, that is, it's one impersonal reality. And then it continues to differentiate through this kind of transformation into a more panentheistic and panenhenic view. So this is the idea that the Tao is actually manifesting through the world. The Tao is manifesting through nature. On some level, the world and nature are the Tao. That includes us, right? That includes our bodies. So I'll talk about this more later, but there also tends to be this emphasis in Taoism on a psychosomatic view, right, of personhood. We're connected to the Tao energetically, we're connected to the Tao physically, we're connected to the Tao on all these different levels. It's also related to Taoist cosmology, or the underlying patterns and principles of the universe and theology, or the conceptions of the sacred. So when you're thinking about these Taoist views that are informing Taoist practice and Taoist ideas of language, it's really important to kind of keep in mind the relationship to the conception of the sacred, that is Taoist theology, certain kinds of claims about the origins of the universe, cosmogony, and then the way the universe actually works, cosmology. As preparation for deeper inquiry, we should also familiarize ourselves with some of the foundational dimensions of Taoist history and defining characteristics of the Taoist tradition. In my revisionist interpretive framework, we may speak of Taoist history in terms of the seven periods and four divisions. So the seven periods are really trying to give us a more sophisticated understanding of the different historical periods in terms of Chinese history, but also the Taoist tradition itself. So they're associated with different dynasties or historical periods, which I'm not going to go over in the interest of time. The four divisions are bringing our attention to changes in social organization. So when you talk about classical Taoism, it's primarily lineages of master-disciple communities. When you get into early organized Taoism, this is where something like an organized religious tradition really starts to begin. So there's a more kind of self-conscious religious identity, a kind of social community with like clear demarcations. The shift from early organized Taoism to later organized Taoism is the movement into a kind of strong monastic tradition in Taoism, partially under Buddhist influence. And then modern Taoism is really trying to bring our attention to what's going on in the context of modernity, especially if you're thinking about Chinese history. I don't know if you know much about Chinese history, but 1912, that is the end of dynastic rule in China, moving into 1978, which is when there were major socioeconomic reforms in China, including an increase in religious freedom, and then I would say also the globalization of Taoism that happens at that point. Each of these periods and divisions is diverse and complex, so don't worry, I'm not going over this. Okay. But what I'm trying to bring your attention to is that each period and division consists of specific figures, movements, revelations, and so forth. Here, I simply want to emphasize an alternative and informed way of understanding Taoism, including the recognition that the received distinction between so-called philosophical Taoism, quote-unquote, and so-called religious Taoism, quote-unquote, is inaccurate and outdated. In place of these, we may speak of classical Taoism and organized Taoism, and leave the question of their philosophical and religious, quote-unquote, dimensions. As I've already mentioned, and as documented in my recent book, The Taoist Tradition, I believe that Taoism began as a religious tradition comprised of loosely related master-disciple communities in the Warring States period. These are the inner cultivation lineages of classical Taoism. They emphasized apophatic meditation aimed at mystical union with the Tao. So in the remainder of my presentation, I want to focus primarily on the inner cultivation lineages of classical Taoism. Although conventionally associated with the Book of Venerable Masters, the Laozi, and the Book of Master Zhuang, the Zhuangzi, recent revisionist scholarship by Harold Roth of Brown University and others would add additional texts. These additional texts are especially important for providing more technical information on classical Taoist religious praxis. For present purposes, I want to simply bring your attention to the fact that the earliest text is the Neiye, the inward training chapter of the Guanzi, the Book of Master Guan, which dates to around 350 BCE, and that the latest text is the Huainanzi, the Book of the Huainan Masters, which was submitted to the Chinese Emperor in 139 BCE. Thus, classical Taoism existed from the Warring States period to the early Han Dynasty, or the 4th to the 2nd centuries BCE. Especially important for classical and foundational Taoist views of language is the Zhuangzi. Traditionally speaking, the text is associated with Zhuangzhou, the classical Taoist elder after whom the text is titled. So it's interesting, right? Because different Taoists are represented in different ways. So if you're thinking about iconography, a lot of times there's like a standard iconography, the way that someone's represented. But there is no standard iconography of Zhuangzi, right? So literati really love to kind of present him as this dignified scholar. But I'd say this is more of like a Taoist representation of him, right? He doesn't have his shoes on, right? His robe's open. He's got some scrolls that he's sleeping on. He's sleeping. And Taoists like to sleep. Yeah. If you know more about the Zhuangzi, he's probably dreaming. If you know more about the Zhuangzi, so my first slide, he could be dreaming that he's a butterfly. Or is he a butterfly dreaming he's Zhuangzi? A very famous Taoist story. Yeah. So thinking about the way that he's represented. But in general, in the Taoist tradition, he represents this idea of carefree ease. right, of effortless kind of activity. So this is one kind of representation of him. He is thought to be more of along lines of freedom, subversiveness, wildness. In the later Taoist tradition, he's regarded as a sage, a shengren. Sometimes Taoists will even talk about him as a perfected, a genren. But moving back to Zhuangzhou as a historical person, we know very little about him. In terms of the text, scholars generally identify the so-called inner chapters, chapters 1 through 7, as containing his teachings and writings. However, the received text, the 33-chapter recension of Guo Xiang, who died in 312 CE, is actually a multivocal anthology with a variety of historical and textual layers. This is true of all the texts of classical Taoism, including the Laozi. Thus, I translate the latter title as the Book of Venerable Masters, rather than the conventional Book of Master Lao. Recent revisionist scholarship on the Book of Master Zhuang by A.C. Graham, Liu Xiaogan, Victor Mayer, and Harold Roth identifies various lineages and schools associated with the remaining chapters. Don't worry, I'm not going over this either. These lineages had shared cosmological and theological views, that is, about the Tao. They emphasized specific practices, apophatic meditation, and aimed at specific experiences, mystical union with the Tao. While they were connected by shared worldviews as well as foundational meditative techniques, on some level, their existential applications were at variance. These teachers and communities were committed to cultivating the Tao, but they often disagreed on the most efficacious methods and the extent of its application, specifically in the realm of social engagement and political involvement. So hopefully people picked up that point. This is a major area of confusion in interpreting classical Taoist texts. That is, they have a shared kind of repertoire of techniques, a shared worldview, but they're debating about whether or not you should have social engagement or political involvement. This is the fundamental disagreement that they have. Should you run for the hills, or should you try to stay in society and help people? Okay. So the way that I tend to think about classical Taoism is this is a question about application. Right. It's not a question about the defining characteristics of Taoism or some of the essential aspects. It's about what do you do after you become a realized being? What do you do in the world, if anything? Okay, with this background in mind, we may now move on to examine classical Taoist contemplative practice, specifically apophatic meditation, that is, meditation in which emptiness and stillness are primary. Here, I will simply remind you that from my perspective, Taoist apophatic discourse presupposes contemplative practice and mystical experience, which I will discuss shortly. You must fast. I will tell you what this means. Do you think that it is easy to do anything when you have a heart mind? If you do, the luminous heavens will not support you. Make your aspirations one. Don't listen with your ears. Listen with your heart mind. No, don't listen with your heart mind. Listen with qi. Listening stops with the ears. The heart mind stops with joining. But qi is empty and waits on all things. The Tao gathers in emptiness alone. Emptiness is the fasting of the heart mind. Xing jai. I'm improving. I can sit in forgetfulness. I smash up my limbs and body, drive out perception and intellect, cast off form, do away with understanding, and make myself identical with great pervasion. This is what I mean by sitting in forgetfulness. It's all along. So here's a kind of sampling of instructions on Taoist meditation, specifically apophatic meditation, emphasizing kind of extracting yourself from phenomenal existence, slowly decreasing sensory engagement, letting go of emotional and intellectual engagement, and then getting into this place of stillness. And specifically here, which I'll talk about in a moment, this idea of qi and the heart-mind. Okay? So when we think of classical Taoist apophatic meditation, it's focusing on emptiness and stillness, and this is one of the key points. It's contentless. It's non-conceptual, and it's non-dualistic. So this is the informing worldview. This is also the way that the experience is described. The informing view is that one's original nature, Xing, is the Tao. There is no necessary distinction between the human and the sacred. In fact, from a Taoist perspective, the Tao is immanent in all things, at least to some degree. And all things participate in the Tao's enfolding mystery. Contemplative practice deepens this sense. Here one also notes the use of Taoist technical terms, namely qi and the heart-mind, xin. The former is an all-pervading sacred breath which circulates through the cosmos and even the body. The latter is the seat of consciousness. So I'll return to the informing psychology momentarily. Combining these passages with others from the classical Taoist textual corpus, specifically the inward training chapter of the Book of Master Guan, we discover that there's a specific posture and psychosomatic view of contemplative practice. So in the text, the way it's reconstructed, especially by Harold Roth, you have these four dimensions, this fourfold alignment. Aligning the body, aligning the four limbs, aligning the qi, and aligning the heart-mind. So this is a kind of sequence, right? Moving from the physical into the energetic, into the kind of spiritual center. That is, from a classical Taoist perspective, if one recognizes the importance of energetic and psychological harmonization as foundational for attunement with the Tao, one must first align one's body. This postural alignment is the root of meditative praxis. In the later Taoist tradition, the analogy of a lotus flower emerging from a muddy pond is used. Based on roughly contemporaneous archaeological discoveries, we may reconstruct the actual posture. People familiar with Japanese culture and Japanese Zen Buddhism in particular will probably think of the seiza position, that is, sitting on one's heels. This was actually one of the standard seated postures in ancient China. In my own studies of contemplative practice, one thing that I enjoy considering, perhaps bizarrely, is the history of furniture. While we may take sitting in chairs and specific kinds of chairs for granted, there is a history to such material culture, and this also relates to meditation. In the case of Taoism, it appears that sitting on one's heels was the earliest meditation posture, eventually followed by sitting on small stools, and then, under the influence of Buddhism, using the full lotus posture. Comparatively speaking, one may thus consider the embodied, kinesthetic, that is movement-based, and material dimensions of human existence. In any case, one key dimension of Taoist contemplative practice is the underlying psychosomatic mind-body view of personhood. Here we find that corporeal alignment is required for energetic alignment, which is in turn required for psychological and spiritual alignment. That is, one's posture and embodied condition are directly related to one's energetic and psychological experience. From a Taoist cosmological perspective, this is because an aligned body creates the context for a more direct connection with and participation in the cosmos. So one way that Taoists talk about this is the crown of the head as the place where celestial qi, tian qi, enters the body. And if you're sitting in a meditation posture on the ground, the perineum, the base of the torso, being the point where terrestrial qi, di qi, enters the body. So literally with an aligned body, right, from a Taoist perspective, these two types of energies are moving into and out of and through the body and joining in the body. Within the relevant textual passages, one also notices the central importance of the heart-mind. The Tao fills all under the heavens. It is everywhere where people reside, but people are unable to recognize it. When you explore the whole meaning, you extend up to the heavens above and stretch down to the earth below. You pervade the nine inhabited regions. What does it mean to investigate this? The answer resides in the calmness of the heart-mind. When your heart-mind is governed, the senses then are also governed. When your heart-mind is calm, the senses are also calm. The heart-mind is what governs them. The heart-mind is what calms them. Store the heart-mind by means of the heart-mind. Within the heart-mind, there is yet another heart-mind. This inner heart-mind is an awareness that precedes language. So this passage is quite complicated in terms of a kind of traditional Chinese view of psychology, because xin can mean the physical heart mind, xin can also mean consciousness, the storehouse of spirit. So there are a number of ways of reading this passage. One way is to say your physical heart mind actually contains consciousness. This would be the kind of most straightforward, right, the easiest. But I think what Taoists are actually saying is the physical heart mind and consciousness or spirit are connected. So as you kind of empty the heart mind out, you find that there's another heart mind. That is, you find that inside of your habituated nature, inside of your conditioned way of thinking and perceiving, is this deeper kind of connection, right, to the Tao from a Taoist perspective. For present purposes, it is also noteworthy that this inner heart mind is an awareness that precedes language. That is, from a classical and foundational Taoist perspective, there is a form of consciousness that is non-conceptual and non-linguistic, and perhaps more radically, pre-conceptual and pre-linguistic. At the very least, such claims suggest that consciousness is more complex than conventional emphases on reason, intellect, and so forth. Some scholars have labeled this as mystical consciousness, quote unquote. For example, Bernard McGinn, a famous scholar of Christian mysticism, with various parallel categories, such as pure consciousness events by Robert Foreman and others, and absolute unitary being, for example, by Eugene de Quilly. Although beyond the present talk, such considerations require engagement with consciousness studies, mysticism studies, neuroscience, psychology, and so forth. We may in turn recognize that there's an informing psychology related to Taoist contemplative practice. This relates to Taoist views of consciousness and philosophy of mind. Developing Han DeWitt, who wrote the seminal book Contemplative Psychology in 1991, we may label this Taoist contemplative psychology, as it distinguishes ordinary consciousness from realized or transformed consciousness. This is psychology informed by and applicable to contemplative practice and contemplative experience. The distinction between conditioned and ordinary and realized and transformed corresponds to the degree to which the given practitioner is aligned or attuned with the Tao. Taoist psychology centers on the heart-mind. Interestingly, the Chinese character depicts an actual heart. It refers to both the physical heart and consciousness in a more abstract sense. Due to the psychosomatic nature of such Taoist views, these are interconnected. On the visceral level, and in terms of Chinese correlative cosmology, these include wood, liver, ethereal soul, huan, fire, heart, spirit, shen, earth, spleen, thought, yi, metal, lungs, corporeal soul, po, and water, kidneys, will, zhi. For present purposes, we must understand that the heart-mind is considered the seat of emotional and intellectual activity, as well as the storehouse of spirit. Although open to interpretation, the latter faculty is a spiritual and perhaps divine, or at least mysterious one. The purpose of Taoist apophatic meditation is to purify the heart-mind of excess emotional and intellectual activity, to return it to its original condition, which is characterized by stillness. Inward training refers to such a process and psychological condition as clearing out the lodging place of the numinous, quote unquote, chapter 13. The resultant stillness is one expression of the stillness, which is the Tao. Such a Taoist contemplative psychology is directly connected to Taoist cosmogony, and you may recall my earlier representation. So as we was talking about with the cosmogony, there's a movement from non-differentiation to differentiation. So Taoists also think about this in terms of how we come to experience the world psychologically. That is, an emergence into being, right? A movement from primordial non-differentiation, our connection to the Tao, to differentiation. So from awareness to some kind of an intellectual and emotional engagement, to sense perception, to physicality. But then Taoists are interested in these moments of return. So the first return to non-being is a movement from differentiation back to non-differentiation, specifically in terms of activity and stillness. That is, from physicality to sense perception to intellectual and emotional engagement to awareness to mystical abiding. This is the kind of map of contemplative practice and contemplative experience. But what I'll talk about in a moment is there's another return that happens, and that's the return to our daily lives. So movement from this non-differentiation, the stillness, to differentiation, to activity. So movement from mystical abiding to transformative types of awareness, intellectual and emotional engagement, sense perception, and physicality. That is, there's some kind of transformative effect that happens in our embodied being in the world. So this is one of the primary purposes of classical Taoist apophatic meditation, namely returning to the source, Guigun. So you call that one of the Taoist conceptions of the Tao is source. Mysticism is central to the Taoist tradition. As a comparative category, mysticism involves an experience of that which a given individual or community identifies as sacred or ultimately real. From the perspective of mystics, mystical experiences involve a direct experience of a transhuman reality, an interaction between an individual or communal subject and a sacred dimension. In terms of religious traditions, there are different conceptions of the sacred and different types of mystical experience. In the case of classical Taoism, the primary mystical experience involves union with the Tao. I began explaining and kept at him, sho, so this is a very important technical term in Taoism related to meditation, and kept at him for 3 days. And after that, he was able to put the world outside himself. When he had put the world outside of himself, I kept at him for 7 more days. And after that, he was able to put things outside himself. When he had put things outside of himself, I kept at him for 9 more days, and after that, he was able to put life outside of himself. After he had put life outside of himself, he was able to achieve the brightness of dawn, and when he achieved the brightness of dawn, he could see his own aloneness. After he had managed to see his own aloneness, he could do away with past and present, and after he had done away with past and present, he was able to enter where there is no life and no death, from Zhuangzi, chapter 6. So these are a set of instructions that are given about Taoist meditation, and specifically about how one returns to non-differentiation, to this kind of state of stillness. Interestingly, this passage is a dialogic exchange between Niu Yu, woman Yu, yes, so there were female Taoist masters back in the day, a female Taoist elder, and her student Bu Liangyi, dividing beam support. As so much of the Book of Master Zhuang consists of such discourse records, quote-unquote, I would suggest that a more sophisticated, contextual, and praxis-based reading would consider the didactic or teaching dimension. We are dealing with person and context-specific teachings between teachers and students, especially members of the inner cultivation lineages. According to Woman Yu, also known as Woman Crookback, so if you're reading Burton Watson, he translates this as Woman Crookback, or it could also be translated as the female recluse. There are 7 stages of practice and levels of attainment. So externalizing the world, this is me reconstructing, right, from the passage. Externalizing things, externalizing life, pervading the brightness of dawn, realizing aloneness, doing away with past and present, and entering where there is no death and no life. So if you're following this as instructions about Taoist apophatic meditation, there's a centering down. There's a disengaging of sense perception. There's a stilling of intellectual and emotional activity. And eventually, and this is quite radical, that you get this a lot in classical Taoism, eventually timelessness and deathlessness. So there's a kind of question there about what does deathlessness mean here. But it's connected to Taoist views of death, dying, and the afterlife, which I'm not really going to talk about tonight, but specifically life and death as a transformative process, no different. So how do you actually merge yourself into this transformative process of the Tao? And one way, according to classical Taoism, is through meditation. There is a similar dialogic exchange between Huzi, Gourd Master, and Lieze, Master Lie, in the Book of Master Zhuang. A disciple of Gourd Master, Master Lie, momentarily becomes enamored with the shaman Ji Xian. The latter attempts to diagnose Gourd Master using various psychic methods, such as physiognomy, that is, facial divination. Each time that Ji Xian arrives, he finds Gourd Master manifesting a different energetic state. On the 4th meeting, Ji Xian flees in terror, running so fast that Master Liet cannot catch him. During the subsequent dialogic exchange, Gord Master explains to Master Liet that he had revealed four mystical states, suggesting that accomplished practitioners may and do transform in multiple ways. So he talks about the nine abysses. Where the swirling waves gather, there is an abyss. Where the still waters gather, there is an abyss. Where the running waters gather, there is an abyss. The abyss has nine names. And then he lists, right, the first four, but not five through nine. So when you look at this, there's a movement towards increasing degrees of non-differentiation. It's noteworthy that the first four are mentioned, right? But that the five through nine are unmentioned and perhaps unmentionable. That is, unsayable, indescribable. Following this exchange, Master Liet instructively decides that he has had little spiritual realization, especially compared to what Gord Master actually embodies and manifests. He in turn goes into a 3-year seclusion during which he engages in consistent and prolonged contemplative practice. There are various Taoist technical terms related to apophatic meditation and mystical experience. So here's just a sample of some of the ones that you find in Taoist texts. I'll return to the actual linguistic dimension shortly. Along these lines, it may be helpful to make a distinction between introverted mysticism and extroverted mysticism. So I borrow these terms from Harold Roth of Brown University, who is developing Walter Stace's discussion in Mysticism and Philosophy. As I will soon discuss, I would suggest that certain Taoist linguistic expressions are a form of extroverted mysticism. That is, like Woman Yu and Gord Master, they are attempts to inspire actual contemplative practice and mystical experience, specifically union with the Tao. This union may be both an internal state and an external activity. A close reading of the Book of Master Zhuang reveals various elders of classical Taoist inner cultivation lineages, often identified or imagined as characters in some proto-fiction. So this is one of the understandings of the text that I find problematic. And various kind of entertaining stories about Taoist practice realization. So these are some of the most famous stories. I don't know if you've had a chance to read the Zhuangzi, but Taoists kind of know these by heart. This is part of Taoist folklore. In my way of reading and interpreting the text, these stories provide insights into and models for aspiring Taoist adepts. Here we may recall the dialogic and didactic aspects of the texts. The stories are also subversive, presenting radically different ontological and psychological models. So you find these kinds of philosophical dyads in the text. To engage in a radical rereading of the Book of Master Zhuang, perhaps a Zhuangist one, one finds that the text includes a variety of philosophical dyads. I have placed philosophy in scare quotation marks in order to indicate that I do not believe philosophy is the correct category, unless one begins to rethink the history of Western philosophy in light of scholars such as Pierre Hadot and the characteristics of so-called Asian philosophy, quote-unquote, in the light of post-colonialism. This is especially the case if one understands philosophy in terms of disembodied thought and ideas, thinking, and knowing. Such readings of the Book of Master Zhuang will always result in confusion and misunderstanding because they're exactly the types of cognitive modes and ways of reading the text and its associated teachers that they attempt to subvert. Although the text is consistently read by comparative philosophers and scholars of Chinese philosophy, quote-unquote, as advocating so-called skepticism, relativism, and so forth, I believe this is a misreading. In keeping with the text itself, there is a fundamental distinction between contemplatives and intellectuals, or mystics and theologians, assuming that the latter reject the former. One of the primary insights of the Book of Master Zhuang is that there are more encompassing and more limited forms of consciousness. In keeping with classical Taoism, this often centers on conditions of knowing, quote-unquote, and non-knowing, quote-unquote. Abiding in a condition of non-knowing is directly connected to contemplative practice and mystical experience. And from this state, one uses language in radically different ways. ways that conventional interpretations fail to comprehend. Habituated consciousness attempts to colonize and domesticate them into forms of knowing, quote unquote. That is, rather than confront the soteriology, the ultimate purpose of such expressions, conventional interpretations prevent the elders of classical Taoism from speaking the unspeakable. This is, perhaps, why conversations such as the present one are so surprising in the context of modern academia. In terms of introvertive and extrovertive mystical experience, we find various types of transformation. As mentioned, introvertive mystical experience is about interiority, especially subjective experiencing and psychological states. The understanding of the lesser person never gets beyond gifts and wrappings, letters and calling cards. He wastes his essential spirit on the shallow and trivial, and yet wants to be the savior of both beings and the Tao, to blend both form and emptiness in great unity. Such a person will blunder and go astray in space and time. His body entangled, he will never come to know the great beginning. But the utmost person lets his essential spirit return to the beginningless, to lie down in pleasant slumber in the village of nothing whatsoever. Like water, he flows through formless or trickles forth from great purity. How pitiful, you whose understanding can be encompassed in a hair tip, who know nothing of great tranquility. So what this is talking about in general terms is these kinds of degrees of non-differentiation. And if you think again about Taoist cosmogony, this return to this kind of primordial state of being merged with the Tao. However, perhaps more interestingly, the Book of Master Zhuang also describes forms of extrovertive mystical experience, or ways in which the Tao becomes embodied in the world. There are various stories about the transformation of action that occur through contemplative practice and the resultant states. A very famous story, Cook Ding. Cook Ding was cutting up an ox for Lord Wen Hui. At every touch of his hand, every heave of his shoulder, every move of his feet, every thrust of his knee, zip, zoop, he slithered the knife along with a zing, and all was in perfect rhythm, as though he were performing the dance of the mulberry grove or keeping time to Jingshou music. "Ah, this is marvelous," said Lord Wen Hui. "Imagine skill reaching such heights." Cook Ding laid down his knife and replied, "What I care about is the Tao, which goes beyond skill. When I first began cutting up oxen, all I could see was the ox itself. After 3 years, I no longer saw the whole ox. And now I go at it by spirit, Shun, and don't look with my eyes. Perception and understanding have come to stop, and spirit moves where it wants. I go along with the natural makeup, strike in the big hollows, guide the knife through the big openings, and follow things as they are, so I never touch the smallest ligament or tendon, much less a main joint. A good cook changes his knife once a year because he cuts. A mediocre cook changes his knife once a month because he hacks. I've had this knife of mine for 19 years, and I've cut up thousands of oxen with it, and yet the blade is as good as though it just came from the grindstone. There are spaces between the joints and the blade of the knife where the blade of the knife really has no thickness. If you insert what has no thickness into such spaces, then there's plenty of room, more than enough for the blade to play about it. That's why after 19 years, the blade of my knife is still as good as when it first came from the grindstone. However, whenever I come to a complicated place, I size up the difficulties, tell myself to watch out and be careful, keep my eyes on what I'm doing, work very slowly, and move the knife with the greatest subtlety until, flop, the whole thing comes apart like a clod of earth crumbling to the ground. I stand there holding the knife and look all around me, completely satisfied and reluctant to move on, and then I wipe off the knife and put it away. Excellent, said Lord Wen Hui. I've heard the words of Cook Ding and learned how to care for life, Yang Sheng. So there's a lot of these kinds of jokes in Taoism as well, right? That is, you learn the secret of caring for life by watching somebody cut up a dead ox. It's quite strange, right? But from a Taoist perspective, this is about the kind of transformation of activity that expresses this attunement with the Tao. So we are now in a position to summarize classical Taoist meditative praxis, mystical experience, and soteriology, with soteriology being a comparative category that refers to actualization, liberation, perfection, realization, salvation, or however one defines the ultimate purpose of human existence. So we've already talked about the informing view of these different characteristics of the Tao, that the primary practice is the stillness or emptiness-based practice, that mystical experience is ultimately about union with the Tao, but that there's an introvertive and an extrovertive element, and that the soteriology is attunement with the Tao. From this, we may also reflect on various issues derived from and applicable to religious studies, to the academic study of religion. So thinking about embodiment, what's the place of the body in all of this? Consciousness, that is, there are different maps of consciousness. There are different kinds of psychologies at work in these practices. What kind of mysticism are we dealing with? What kinds of mystical experiences are described, including some maybe some kind of transformed experiencing, right, the way we are in the world. Praxis, the relationship between this and what we call philosophy or theology, and then actual claims about the ultimate purpose of our lives and what's ultimately real. Now, for those of you wondering what any of this has to do with language in general, and apophatic discourse in particular, your time has come. As I've already stated, I believe that understanding Taoist contemplative practice and mystical experience is required for understanding Taoist linguistic expressions. Especially in the case of classical Taoism, the use of language on its multiple levels is rooted in contemplative and mystical perspective. So thinking about Taoist grammars of ineffability, linguistics and philosophy, as I mentioned, this is informed by contemplative practice and mystical experience. It's connected to this idea of what the ultimate purpose of human existence is and what's ultimately real. Apophatic language, that is negational language, is actually primary. So what you find is this oscillation back and forth between affirmation and negation. When you start to look at these passages, conventionally it looks like negation, right? But negation is preliminary, it's corrective. It's people who are attached to all the affirmations. So the first thing that's going on is the repeated use of not and without, bu, fei, or wu. And so there's this kind of un, right? It's not that, we're undoing that. But I think ultimately from my perspective, I'm gonna show you some examples in a moment, it's actually about experience beyond negation. So it's about a trans state. It's about a beyond state. It's not an un. It's beyond un. Yeah, so I don't know if you're following that, but I'll get into some examples. Another really interesting part of the Zhuangzi and classical Taoism is it's subversive and it's transformative. Okay. So in the opening slide, I had this kind of slide of Zhuangzi dreaming and the character Meng for dreaming. So there's a lot of discussion in classical Taoism about dreaming and awakening. And sometimes it's hard to figure out which one they're privileging. Yeah, sometimes they seem to be privileging dreaming. Sometimes they seem to be privileging awakening. And then I will remind you about those Taoist philosophical dyads, right? Thinking about where people are located in relation to this. Some examples of nons are emotionless, formless, nameless, non-action, non-knowing, and so forth. You also have what I mentioned to you before, the mystery beyond mystery. Yeah, the Tao, so this Shenzhi Yoshen. What I mentioned to you from the Neiye, from the inward training, right? An awareness that precedes language. Yeah. And then lastly, which I haven't talked about, is a famous line in the Tao Te Ching that talks about the Tao as the image, the Xiang, that precedes Di, Thiar. So if you read popular translations of the Tao Te Ching, they always polish this out because they don't want you to think that there's actually polytheism in classical Taoism, okay? But they're in a polytheistic context. And Di is the high god of the Shang pantheon. So the Shang dynasty was one of the earliest dynasties in China. And so Taoists are like, you have this received pantheon. You know all these gods. What we're talking about is an image before that god existed. Not the thing. The thing that represents the thing. That's what the Tao is. Yeah. So now you can maybe, if you know something about like kind of comparative mysticism, right, this kind of like maybe Godhead beyond God idea and things along these lines. Okay. So let us look at some specific examples. So I'm close to finishing, but just I want to give you some examples before I finish. The first relate to linguistics and psychology, and specifically the classical and foundational Taoist emphasis on non-knowing, wu zhi. To know that one does not know is best. Not to know that one is knowing is sickness. It is only by being sick of sickness that one ceases being sick. So if you analyze this on a linguistic level, there's all these boos here, right? And it looks like what they're really talking about is the negation of something. So the negation of knowing, right, is on the one hand, but also the negation of sickness. So those are connected. So if you have any knowledge of medical anthropology, this might be an interesting theory of sickness. It has nothing to do with like a physical condition, right? It's the state of your mind. So if you start to think about this idea of non-knowing, there's this repetition of the characters, and there's this apparent strong negation. But this passage actually expresses a hierarchical ordering of consciousness and spiritual realization. So if you think through this passage, this is a lot of what I try to do in my own work. If you think through this passage, what is its actual map of consciousness? The highest is non-knowing, wu zhi. That is actually being in a state of non-knowing. The next best is knowing that you don't know. That's pretty good. Yeah, I have no idea. Good. Right. Or another way to read zhi bu zhi is to know that not knowing is possible. That is, you haven't entered a state of non-knowing, but at least you're open to the possibility that you could be in this state of pure consciousness. Right. Next is zhi zhi, knowing that you're knowing. Like, okay, you're knowing, fine, but at least you know that you know, which is you don't really know. And the worst is this. This is the kind of lowest level, and this is like a kind of ordinary condition of mind from Taoist perspective. That is, not knowing that you're knowing. That is, your like ordinary state of mind. I know this, I know that. It's like that. It's always like that, right? It's always been like this. So this kind of thing. So how do you move from a kind of state of psychological sickness, quote unquote, into a state of non-knowing? And of course, this is part of the fundamental argument. This is not philosophical. This is not conceptual. You'll never get here through intellect and reason. Right? This is the apophatic meditation part. Right? The only way is to actually enter stillness, to enter emptiness, right? To get out of all of these different conditions. Yeah? Another interesting example comes from the Book of Master Zhuang. This passage centers on the resolution of perplexity and specifically the ultimate non-goal of entering a state of non-perplexity. Or wu huo. So if you look at the Taoism Guide for the Perplexed book that comes out, you actually see these are the two opening quotations in the book. Okay. We may say that there is a great aspiration, may we not? Why not inquire about it? Why act in such perplexity? If we use unperplexity to dispel perplexity and return to non-perplexity, this will be the greatest non-perplexity. So again, on the linguistic level, you have these boos. But I think in this case, you're getting a clear sense of what Taoists are actually doing with this negational language, which is on the one hand, you have to get rid of perplexity. You have to bu huo, you have to negate it. But on the other hand, what you really want is wu huo, non-perplexity. So how do you move from perplexity into losing perplexity into actually no longer being into any kind of state of perplexity? Right. So this is open to interpretation, but this is my fundamental way of reading it, which is the first part is about a kind of negation or a movement away or an un, and the last part is about a trans or a beyond perplexity. Taoist apophatic discourse also relates to Taoist cosmogony or discourse on the origins of the universe. There was a beginning. There was not yet beginning to be a beginning. There was not yet beginning to be not yet beginning to be a beginning. There was being. There was non-being. There was not yet beginning to be non-being. There was not yet beginning to be not yet beginning to be non-being. Suddenly there was non-being. But when it comes to non-being, I don't know what is being and what is non-being. Now I have just said something, but I don't know whether or not what I have said has really said something. So ultimately, there are different ways of reading this. But one of the primary ways of reading this is it's actually an account of Taoist cosmogony, right? right? It's like, how did it all begin? We're not quite sure. Oh, I really want to know how it began. Okay, there was a beginning. Well, that's not good enough. What happened then? Oh, there was not yet beginning to be a beginning. Okay, right? So what they're trying to actually do, right, is subvert that tendency of cosmogonic speculation. There's no way to know from a Taoist perspective. So how do we speak in such a way, right, where that becomes more accessible? Another really interesting part about this and the other passages that I showed you is they eventually become Taoist technical terms for cosmogony, beginninglessness, right, non-being, and things like this. Taoist apophatic discourse also relates to Taoist theology, or discourse on the Tao. I do not know its name, so this is really important, the characters that they're using, the terms. I do not know its name. I style it Tao, so Ming and Zi. Forced to name it further, I call it great. That's from the Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching. So from a later text, a 9th century text, the great Tao is without name. It raises and nourishes the 10,000 beings. I do not know its name. Forced to name it, I call it Tao. From my way of looking at this, the characters are essential for understanding what Taoists are saying about what's ultimately real. Here, Ming is your given personal name, the name that your family gives you when you're born. Zi is a style name. It's a literary name. Like, you can take one, other people can give it to you. It's a nickname. Then there's another Ming. So it's like, now you're into human beings talking about it. So this is the Ming that we give it. Yeah. So I don't know any of the first two, but I can talk to you about how I want it to be called. That is the Tao. Right? And then the second passage clarifies this. Yeah. So the Tao is a placeholder for that which transcends names and naming. Here are some different ways that Taoists talk about the Tao. Okay, but even the Tao is not the Tao. That's the fundamental Taoist perspective on this in terms of apophatic discourse. That's how radical it is, right? We'll even negate the name that we gave you for it, right? Which seems to mean we've actually negated our own tradition. Now, this is one way of kind of thinking about this. So in my own attempt to think through Taoist negative theology and apophatic mysticism, I have occasionally used brackets. However, the bracket should probably be facing outwards so that everything else is bracketed. And it is still a container. Alternatively, one might choose darkness or silence, which I've given you as well. From these considerations, we may turn to explicit classical Taoist discussions of language, philosophical argumentation, and theological discourse. So I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to read these. But basically, they're talking about the ways that people argue about things. And it seems that there's apparent skepticism and relativism. But actually, I would say it's contemplative and mystic. It's transrational. It's consciousness and being beyond argumentation or conceptualization or intellectual apprehension. It's about alignment and attunement and direct experience. So now, of course, historians, social critics, philosophers, and the like will argue that there is no such thing as pure consciousness or direct experience. But such views are rooted in particular assumptions and experiences. From a classical Taoist perspective, contemplative practice and mystical experience involve deconditioning, effortlessness, forgetting, letting go, unlearning, and so forth. In terms of a contemplative approach, one may analyze specific perspectives in terms of tension, relaxation, agitation, stillness, confusion, clarity, and so forth. That is, sitting in silence and emptiness may resolve apparently unresolvable debates and may accept apparently unacceptable non-descriptions of that which transcends names and argumentation. Perhaps, as the Book of Venerable Masters suggests, clarity and stillness, Qingjing, are the rectification of the world. Perhaps silence resolves perplexity. The transformative effect of contemplative practice may result in a different type of philosophizing and theologizing, one that accepts both ultimate unknowability and the human aspiration for comprehension and communication. We may, in turn, apply these insights to the comparative study of language and soteriology. So Taoism emphasizing more apophatic theology, right? That is, reality beyond names and conceptions. And one thing I'm trying to think through is Chinese language itself, which is pictographic and ideogrammatic. So is there a way in which Chinese actually shows you more clearly the relationship between the signifier and the signified? That there's an emphasis on embodied being and experiencing, and then there's this kind of energetic dimension. So I don't know how much you know about the different languages, the way they're used in different traditions, but you find these views in certain forms of Hinduism or Islam or Judaism that somehow the language itself is directly connected to the sacred. That is, this is the language through which the sacred communicates to human beings, right? And Taoists are like, the sacred doesn't communicate through language. Right? It's beyond language. So it's something to be thinking about in comparative perspective. In terms of Taoist mystical unsaying, to borrow a phrase from Michael Sells, we may reflect on its various dimensions. Thinking about audience, thinking about genre, thinking about grammar, language, metaphor and symbolism, and the purpose. So focusing more on actual Taoists, speaking to Taoists, that it's about a lot of dialogic exchanges, poetry, stories. A lot more use of adjectives and verbs than nouns in talking about soteriology and theology. This kind of high density of negation, this is definitely a strong characteristic of Taoism. I mentioned the character-based aspect. Metaphor and symbolism, you have a lot of discussions of the Tao as ancestor, mother, mystery, one, source, and so forth. And then what's the purpose? I think one purpose is to actually confuse people. This is not unintentional. Right, and that perplexity itself is subversive. Unperplexity leading to non-perplexity and ultimately to alignment, awakening, freedom, and so forth. So for Taoists, at least for members of classical Taoist inner cultivation lineages and those with similar affinities and aspirations, the elders and models documented in the Book of Master Zhuang suggest that there are transformed existential modes beyond conceptualization and intellectualism, beyond thinking and knowing. Transformed through contemplative practice and introvertive mystical experience, in such a state of being and form of extrovertive mysticism, one may find ways to speak the unspeakable. More importantly, perhaps, one may come to resemble the fish of the Hao River, the great Peng bird, sea turtles, and useless trees. In a state of receptive experiencing and participatory being, one may float with the currents and play among sunlight and shadows. From a Taoist perspective, such is a disappearing in the Tao and a reappearing in the world. Now, in following the Zhuangist hermeneutics, I don't know if I'm a turtle who has wandered in from the ocean or a frog in my own well. And I know that I've just said something, but I don't know whether or not what I've just said has really said something. Perhaps you know. Thank you.
Lovely, thanks so much. Can anyone play a Taoist butcher with their questions? Ask just the right question.
Leah? I so enjoyed that. So wonderful. I'm so happy that you have the 2013 and 14 meeting for free. I might actually be brave enough. I'm just really curious to kind of learn, pick your brain from some of your historical knowledge. I'm really curious about the actual physical practices that would have been going on pre-contact with Buddhism. I'm also, I don't know if you can answer this whole question, but I'm also really curious about what might have been going on during the contemporaneous period on the Indian subcontinent, so both Buddhist and pre-Buddhist for the physical practices, and then the kind of relative influence on Chinese Buddhism after that, like what was being taken.
Yeah, this is a really complicated question. I think I'll choose to answer the first part.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think what I showed you is a lot of the reconstruction, right? So Harold Roth of Brown University is the kind of most influential person that's done the most reconstructed work. Some of his reconstructions I don't agree with. He tends to see breathing practices there, which I think is a Zen Buddhist influence on his interpretation. He tends to see breathing practice, which it's viable. Qi can actually mean physical respiration. But I don't think these Taoists are talking about physical respiration.
They're talking about chi. So in the passages that I showed you, I think you have the reconstruction, which is it looks like kind of a seiza position, to use the Japanese term that people might know, sitting on one's heels, right? Aligning the body, and then actually xingjai, fasting the heart mind, or zuowang. So I love teaching this right in my classes. It's like, oh yeah, we want to go home and do this. Okay, go ahead. Well, we need instruction. You just got the instruction. No, we need actual instruction, right? Zuowang. Sit and forget. That's not good, right? That's the ordinary mind. You just learn the whole lesson. The ordinary mind is like, I need more. It's like, you don't need more. You have everything you need, right? So that's what I mentioned to you about the psychology. The view is that your heart-mind, or your innate nature, is the Tao. And if you enter in from this perspective, if you enter into this stillness, into this emptiness, that's when this kind of clarity or the spiritual insight emerges. So I think it's pretty clear, like the reconstruction is pretty clear of what the foundational practice is, including the forming worldview. So this is one of the main things that interests me, as Professor Knepper said in his introduction. Contemplative practice and mystical experience. Yeah. And so the relationship between the informing worldview, the actual practice that you're doing, and the kinds of experiences that you have. Because like the most logical question is, why would you want to sit in emptiness? It's like, because you're a Taoist, that's right. That's the Taoist answer. Taoists sit in emptiness, or Taoists in silicia. I sit in stillness, and it's like nothing. Can't I get something more than that? So it's like different tradition, right? If you want something more, that's not the Taoist view. It's something less. So this is one of the really radical parts in connecting with the kind of ineffability question. Decreasing, unlearning, right? There's a very famous like phrase, right? In practice every day, Taoists do less. They're unlearning. Yeah. So does that help a little bit? Yeah. But yeah, there's some very clear reconstructions. Some I'd say are more problematic than others. But I think Hal Roth, who is a friend and colleague and one of my mentors actually, I think we agree on the fundamental practice.
So we are dealing with a lot of reconstruction. There's not a whole lot of...
Well, you saw a lot of the passages.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you have to reconstruct them on some level. Yeah. But I think the reconstructions are fairly accurate, at least these kinds. But you can decide for yourself. Do you want them?
So I'm going to order Jeremy and then sorry, I'm going to order your name.
Oh, yeah.
That was the order I saw, so...
Okay. I have a kind of an overarching question,
yeah.
Which is, if the highest part is, you gave us these
non-knowing,
and so knowing, not knowing, being in the state of not knowing, how can you it's a kind of an undifferentiated state. How can an undifferentiated state have hierarchies?
Yeah, but how do you give a person a map to get there?
Yeah, but wouldn't any state then be just as good as any other state?
No, because energetically, see, this is what I mean. This is the conceptualization. This is the intellectualization of it. Energetically, it's not. That's the argument, right? The argument is, here's the map of practice, right? So you need something. I mean, if we just go do it like this, and it's like, okay, do it like that, and now I have no idea where I am. So give the map that kind of maps out like what's going on in the practice itself. And then like when you get into that state, there is this, according to this tradition, right? There's this alignment, or there's this attunement, and there's an energetic dimension to it. So then it's actually experiential, it's lived, and then you go, right, this is all nonsense. But it's not nonsense as long as you're in a conceptual, intellectual state. Right? You need the nonsense to take you there. That's the view. Does that help a little bit?
It helps a little bit. Mm-hmm. I guess this is part of something I'm working on anyway.
Yeah.
Why would this kind of higher energy state, this privileged state, does it always manifest in the same form?
In general, the view, this is one of my arguments about the Taoist tradition, which is probably going to get me into trouble somewhere. But in general, this is my argument about the Taoist tradition. Right. That is, there was a group of people, they were probably before, the earliest texts are the 4th century BCE. But that means there were probably oral teachings before that, and that means there were probably teachers before that. So I think reasonably you can probably say it might be as early as the 5th century BCE, even being somewhat conservative. that there was a group of people that had either had this connection or developed methods to develop this connection, and then they were like, right, this is our tradition. And that's the Taoist tradition. It's the preservation and the transmission of that connection from then all the way through Chinese history. That's my kind of mystical reading of the tradition, right? Historians will find this totally problematic. I mean, I'm a historian too, but I'm a different kind of historian, right? But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people in Taoist studies that will say this is just like, you're reading past all the history. But I think if you ask actual Taoists, and if you read Taoist texts throughout Chinese history, they talk about, and so this also answers your question, they talk about Tao Qi, the Qi of the Tao. And you're like, what? It's all the Qi of the Tao, not from a Taoist perspective. That is, there are different types of Qi with different degrees of differentiation. So the kind of Qi that they're most interested in is Yuan Qi, primordial Qi, or Ling Qi, numinous Qi. And the argument that Taoists make, and it's really not an argument, right, is Taoists manifest this. So you don't go, show me your credentials. You go, okay, let's see it. Right? Manifest the Tao. And they don't say that either, right? They just look at you. I've had this experience all the time in China, right? Drinking tea with Taoists, and they just look at you, and you're like, okay, are you convinced? No, I'm not convinced. Okay, let's move on then. Right? So, yeah, so I think that's one of the key things. That's the Qi-based worldview. You can think this is nonsense. I mean, I always say this to my students. You can think this is nonsense. That's fine with me. But I'm just telling you, I think, what the tradition argues, that Qi is real, and that's what we fundamentally are. That Qi is moving through everything. Qi is moving through your body. Qi is moving through this room. Qi is moving through the universe. And that there are ways to deepen the experience of that. Right? So it's actually not exactly psychosomatic. Because psychosomatic makes it think you think there's a mind and there's a body. But Taoists are actually saying it's a whole spectrum of Qi. Right? Qi is moving through all that. And so what kind of energetic condition or quality does it have?
Yeah, you mentioned that there are women
masters.
Yeah.
Taoists,
and I was wondering.
Well, can I just say one thing? They're Taoist women. This is not controversial. They're Taoist women throughout Chinese history, in all levels of the tradition. So if you look at it comparatively, it's one of the more inclusive and empowering traditions in terms of gender equity. What I'm arguing is the radical part is there's actually women masters in like the 4th century BCE. So that's the radical part. I just want to make sure that that was the kind of
key. That was actually my question. Yeah. If you attributed more to Taoist practice and thought more than simply just the culture in which it arose. So do you think that like Taoists especially were gender neutral now?
So I wouldn't say there's equality because it's still generally a patriarchal tradition. It's very hard to make an argument that a pre-modern tradition has like got that kind of enlightened sensibility. But comparatively, it's much more that way. It's definitely that way as you look throughout Chinese history in terms of other Chinese traditions. And there's a kind of subtext to all this, which is that some people in Taoist studies, this is especially kind of European Sinologists, will say that Taoism is the essence of Chinese culture. And I actually think, no, Taoism is the counterculture of China. Confucianism is the one that got control, right, of the society. And Taoists were like, okay, we've got to figure out how we're going to survive and have a place in this. Yeah. So I think that this part was also their subversion of that, to actually acknowledge women. In this case, it's very interesting because they could have put a female disciple there, hypothetically. They didn't. They put a female master with a male disciple, which is even more radical. Right? So.
Is there a certain, I guess, idea or practice within Taoism
I think that it's somewhat connected to Taoist reading of yin and yang and privileging yin, but that's somewhat problematic because I don't agree that a lot of the Taoist references to like the feminine and the mother is strongly gendered. This is a kind of modern feminist reading of classical Taoism that I don't really agree with. I think that in general, though, what they're talking about is there certain masculine, so we can just set that aside and go, yang qualities that the dominant culture is privileging. And they're like, none of this works. You can fight people forever and somebody's going to die. Or you can just step back and actually allow things to be. And this is one of the key Taoist ideas. Give things the space to unfold in their own natural way. That's what we want. Right? And this is the useless tree bit, right? If you read the useless tree stories, it's what carpenters want to do, so that's the ordinary mind. They want to turn old growth forests into furniture. I don't know, do you guys know old growth forests? Are there old growth forests in Iowa? Okay. There used to be. Yeah, they're in your desks. No. That's what the ordinary mind, and that's what like carpenters as a kind of symbol that wants to do. And what Dallas want to say is, can't you see the tree as it is, in its own being? Let that be, right? That uselessness of it. And that uselessness is a kind of important lesson. So I think if you're looking at it from a kind of ecological perspective, Taoists are saying, you need old growth forests. There's a reason they're getting rid of them. They don't want you to learn those lessons. They don't want those lessons in the world. Because if you learn those lessons, you're like, why are we doing this? But if they're gone, they're like, what lessons? Don't you like Facebook? That's what friendship is. Friendship is like through your computer screen. So Taoists are basically critiquing, I think, the level of mediation in all of it. The mediation of language, the mediation of intellect, right? All of these kinds of things. So uselessness or yin qualities, receptivity. So this is why I hesitate with the gendered part, because then you're like, this is a total gender construct. It's like, yeah, you could read it that way. Right? But if you open it up and say, it's not so much about restricting genders, but saying there's certain kinds of qualities associated with yin and yang, these are the qualities we're more interested in. These are the qualities that the dominant society is more interested in.
Good Taoist that I am, I forgot your name.
Joanna, but he already got to the useless tree, so I'll...
Okay. I'm sorry, I saw Han, and then...
In the Book of Lao Tzu, there's a statement that says, the sage abandons no one. And as a practicing Taoist, I've been struggling with that in terms of questioning to what extent is a Taoist sage committed to other individuals. Mm-hmm. To what extent, you were alluding to this earlier when you were talking about the difference between like practice and whether they isolate themselves from society and become one with society.
Yeah, I think the foundational Taoist view is there's no way to predict what anyone's going to be after practice. This is like what human beings want to do, right? Ordinary human beings want to go, oh yeah, then you become enlightened, then you're not sad anymore. Really? I doubt it. If you're not sad, it seems like there's a problem, right? Maybe you're practicing something that disassociates you. So there are all these kinds of very interesting, I think, philosophical questions about psychological transformations. You know, do you really become free from suffering? Or do you change the way that you experience suffering or the way that you engage suffering, right? That is, you don't ignore it necessarily. So I think the fundamental point about this, though, in terms of a Taoist viewpoint, is that it will manifest differently in different people. And you can't predict it, and you can't mandate it. It's through the practice, people are transformed, and then they do whatever it is they do. Yeah. And so it's that, again, I mean, I oftentimes will draw this analogy with ecology. It's a kind of ecological view, right? When you look at biodiversity, you don't go, I really wish you were all alfalfa crops. Some people do, right? Yes, we know who they are, right? They also genetically engineer corn as fish or something really weird, right? Whatever crazy stuff they come up in these laboratories. But in this context, it's that when you do this kind of practice, it transforms you, and then it manifests in a particular way. That's the extroverted mystical part. For some people, that might be establishing nonprofits. For other people, that might be like, I'm never talking again for the rest of my life. You know? And Taoists are like, yeah, who knows? That's the non-knowing part. You can't actually know how things will unfold for each individual person or each individual being. This is the other part. It tends to be less anthropocentric. They're not actually that interested in human beings. And I'm sure this really drove the Confucians crazy. They're like, we really love fish. They're like, what? We love fish. They're like, well, you know, fish like actually make sense to us. Like they actually swim with the Tao, you know? So I think that's the kind of key thing, is the way it unfolds will be different for different people. And this is straight through. This is why Taoism is so confusing for people to study. Because they're like, wait, now it's like this? Yeah, sure. Well, didn't those people get mad at those Taoists? No. Why not? I don't know. That was their way. Right? That's what Tao means. I mentioned that to you. Right? It means way with a capital W. That is, there's a way pervading everything. But it also means way with a small W, which means Taoists can say, there are all those ways. What are you going to do about it? Accept it, I guess. Or say, it's not for me. This is what you get, the Taoism. Is it's not an unqualified inclusivism. It's, do I have an affinity with that? That's it. I don't? Okay. That's fine. Somebody else might. That's fine.
We have time for one final question.
Yes, please.
First of all, I'd like to say it's really amazing because, you know, how can you comprehend so complicated theories? I mean, even for Chinese, for me, honestly, I just read some passage of the Zhuangzi
It's difficult text.
It's difficult because it's written in very traditional Chinese language and the very traditional Chinese grammar.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing.
Classical Chinese with traditional Chinese characters, yeah.
Yeah. But my question is about the social engagement and based on, you know, the classical Taoism.
Yeah.
Because from my, you know, as a Chinese perspective, and in Chinese social Taoism as, you know, the past.
Escapism.
Yeah. For instance, if you want to compete for something, you don't compete.
Right.
That makes sense to you? So, so I think many ordinary Chinese people don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, do you believe that there's a dozen Jewish people and do not, you know, do things very actively, just let the nature take course?
Yeah. No, I think that that's a kind of pretty traditional misreading of Wu Wei.
Yeah.
Right? Doing nothing.
Yeah.
But that's impossible. Try it. You can. Right? Actually try it. See what happens. You can't sit in your chair if you don't do anything. You need some amount of tension in your body to sit in your chair. If you don't believe me, release all the tension in your body right now. See what happens. So you can't do it. It's impossible to do nothing. Doing nothing is not what they're talking about. What they're talking about is effortless activity. What's the least amount of effort that's required? And this is important. To do something well, they're not interested in mediocrity. They don't say, oh yeah, let's all be mediocre. They're like, when you're aligned with the Tao, right, how does it manifest through you in this kind of effortless way? And so I think what's happened, I think, partly in response to your question, is in the history of Chinese culture, it became incorporated into literati traditions. And literatis love to kind of sleep and drink and be free. And so they're like, this is great. It justifies our own, like, free and easy lifestyle. And the same thing's happening in modern America. It's not different. It's like, oh, yeah, Wu Wei. I get to do whatever I want. You didn't read the Tao Te Ching very carefully. The Tao Te Ching says, decrease desires, lessen personal interest, appear plain, and embrace simplicity. That's all foundational for Wu Wei. So from my perspective, Wu Wei is a practice that can be applied to anything. That's why I showed you the Cook Ding story. Right? Like, well, I have to chop up an ox. No Taoist would ever chop up an ox. That's just horrible. Really? But I mean, I'm a butcher. I have to do something. Right? And so the butcher's like, yeah, let me show you how to do it as a Taoist. There it is. It's like, well, you should have hacked it. Well, if I hacked it, then I have to keep replacing my knife every month. Right? Well, you should have sliced it. Well, if I sliced it, I have to replace it every year. If I do it this way, through Wu Wei, I just still have it for 19 years. And I'm all done. So I think it's not about doing nothing. I think it's about looking at the situation. So that's why the Cook Ding story is very famous and important in Taoism. Can you see the openings? Can you see the spaces? Can you follow those spaces? Right? They're always there. So there's a really profound Taoist theory of space, which is there's always the opening. Right? If you can move fluidly, there's always the opening. But most people can't, right? You just watch people move and move like, you know, I always compare it to like wrecking balls through space, right? Here I come. It's like, okay, go ahead. So.
Well, thank you, Louis, for the lecture.
Thanks for having me.